12. Glenn Ponder, musician. Say what you like about Glenn Ponder, and I have frequently, but he was a virtuoso conductor of lounge music, possibly the most talented, easy-listening battensman of his era. He and his loyal band of minstrels, musicians, were a fixture on the Norwich music scene, effortlessly able to switch between the rival demands of a wine bar, a hotel lobby, or a shopping mall forecourt. He was that versatile. As soon as I saw him and his band in action, I knew that they must be given a big break by me. Glenn had just finished an awe-inspiring during dinner set at Café Symphony in Norwich, now at long last a Nando's. When I decided to broach it, I followed him to his bus stop. "And Mr. Ponder," I shouted as I approached. "Let's have it then, fucker," he said, wheeling round and baring his fists and clenching his teeth. I pretended not to notice and ploughed on. "Great set back there, man," I said, using the word man, so he knew I was familiar with modern music. "Magnificent tracks." He looked at me in order to size me up and gauge my intentions. His breathing was shallow and his eyes were wild. I had to say something. "Are you okay?" I said in a quiet, soothing voice, as if I was a conductor whisperer. He was instantly becalmed. "Sorry about that," he said, now at ease. "I thought you were a mugger." Glenn, it turned out, was responsible for collecting up the coins that were tossed at the band, carrying them home and piggy-banking them. As such, he was often targeted by youths, vagrants, and Scots. Clearly, I was none of these things, and we were able to strike up a conversation. "Wanna be a star?" I asked, casually, pretending to inspect my fingernails. He just looked at me. "I'm Alan Partridge," I said, but he looked at me even more blankly. "From Radio 4's Knowing Me, Knowing You," I added. Still nothing. Then I added the day-to-day and on the hour, fruitlessly. I listed several other pieces of my work, but it wasn't until I mentioned Scoutabout that the penny dropped. Flippin' Scoutabout. Undeterred, I suggested that he and his band sign up with me. He agreed there and then, before we'd even discussed terms or mentioned money, which I found both refreshing and a bit desperate. But I remembered a piece of advice I'd been given by Bernard Matthews. It's when they're tired, desperate, and hungry that they're at their most compliant. I suddenly knew that this could work out very well indeed. Of course it didn't. I made Glenn and his group, Brandy Snaps, current name Vajazzle, my house band, and while not expecting an unending gush of gratitude, I was anticipating a little bit of respect. What I got from Glenn, alongside rank amateurism and off-kilter comic timing, was literally a slap in the face, not literally. And that hurt me. It hurt me a lot, not literally. Full disclosure, my first choice for house band had been the Jeff Lovell Orchestra, the outfit who had re-recorded the theme to Knowing Me, Knowing You for my Radio 4 show. But Jeff was something of a recluse, having badly disfigured his hands, saving an oboe from a van fire. He was also perhaps a little ill-suited to the top-of-the-show comic banter that the role required, having lost his sense of humour in a van fire. That said, I still had high hopes for Glenn and his band, current name Pop Sox. But from the get-go, I'd realised I'd made an error. A week before the show, I'd ordered Glenn to get a haircut, and he'd reluctantly obliged, losing his waist-length corkscrew curls in favour of a shorter, smarter style. But like an adolescent Samson, it was as if the loss of his locks created a lackadaisical attitude to the basics of live TV. Rehearsal, attitude, deference, obeying instructions from the exec producer. I was the exec producer. This resulted in a number of missteps in the live broadcasts, unexpected cymbal crashes, Glenn mumbling, and an all-pervading surliness from the band, which really put me off my stride. My professionalism was such that I didn't betray even a flicker of displeasure on camera, until I was sadly left with literally no choice other than to dismiss him live on air in our fifth show. Let me just lay to rest here and now a baseless accusation. Some have suggested that my relationship with Glenn soured when I learned he was gay. For crying out loud, if I really couldn't bear to consort with homosexuals, do you really think I'd have pursued a career in television? At the BBC, of all places. Be real. I have no issue with gay men. I'm a friend of Dale Winter, for example, one of the gayest men in Europe. Dale and I spent a lovely weekend hanging out at the Earl's Court Boat Show, and he was delightful company. He knows a lot about rigid inflatable boats. I also once shared a stage at a charity dinner with Elton John. Then again, he did used to be married to a woman. I know he's with David Furnish now, but I've long suspected that that relationship is just a cover for his heterosexuality. No, Glenn's sexuality was not a factor. At least not for me. My assistant was a different story. She had enjoyed Glenn's company tremendously, and would probably have classed him as a friend. But her attitude towards him changed like that, when she learned he was gay. Why? Well, she was and is a devout Baptist, and for all their handshaking and tambourine bashing and shouty singing, many of them are staggeringly hard-hearted when it comes to sins of the flesh. My assistant was typical of this worldview, somehow managing to reconcile the twin passions of home-baking and homo-bashing. But back to the sacking. Glenn consulted his lawyer, citing unfair dismissal, his argument that insubordination is a disciplinary issue only in the military and therefore no grounds for dismissal in the private sector, saw him, temporarily, reinstated pending a tribunal in time for the final episode of the series. We muddled through that, a little frostily, but what followed was a regrettable period in which we began to sue and counter-sue each other on a juvenile tit-for-tat basis. It was vindictive, uncalled for, and cripplingly expensive. After several years, Glenn and I managed to patch up our differences. We shared the common ground of both despising our respective lawyers and would often laugh about how much we were spending on their unnecessary legal advice. Glenn lost his flat as a result and lived in a YMCA for 6 months. I dropped my legal actions against him some time ago, but he apologetically intends to pursue his against me because his bandmates are currently suing him for unpaid earnings and he needs the money. And so it is that he forges ahead with his live shows, long past the point that he derives any enjoyment from them. Indeed, with severely arthritic fingers, every swish of the baton is agony for him. I still go and watch him from time to time, and afterwards we go out for a Nando's together. You know which one. I enjoy the taste of chicken and chips enormously, and I'm only slightly put off by Nando's bewildering ordering system, in which customers must pay for food at the counter, set the table themselves, then wait for the waiter to bring the meal over. Interestingly, Glenn and I have developed an unspoken but quietly effective NESS, Nando's efficiency system, in which we ensure that a second is not wasted. We secure a table, then, with coats draped over the back of our chairs, we separate. My role is to grab a menu and secure a place in the queue. From there, I loudly read out the food options so that Glenn can hear. He, meanwhile, is scurrying to the far side of the restaurant to grab cutlery, napkins, and condiments, but all the while he is listening to me and shouting back his order. I place it and pay. We usually end up back at the table at roughly the same time and then enjoy our chicken dinners while chuckling at the many people who are still waiting for theirs, having arrived way before us. Of course, things take on a different hue if you dine solo. Last time I went to Nando's, I was Glenless. I placed my order but forgot about the cutlery. My food arrived and I had neither knife, fork or spoon. Admittedly, in a chicken and chips scenario, the spoon is less important, but I could sure have done with a knife and fork, the former to cut with, the latter to maintain carcass stability. Cursing the absence of my partner in chicken, I went over to get the required eating tools, walking as fast as I could without breaking into a run. Just my luck. They were awaiting a refill on both knives and the forks. Spoons, on the other hand, dozens of them. I had no choice. With a lateral shake of the head and a vertical raise of the eyebrow, I returned to my table. I've made the effort to find cutlery. I'm darn well going to use it. And I have to say, it worked out okay. I shoveled the chips into my mouth as if I was eating pudding, and as for the chicken, it was just a question of trying to drag the meat off the bone by using the spoon as a paw. And what of me and Ponder? Well, I don't talk much about our rekindled friendship. My assistant still harbours an openly bigoted dislike of Glenn and his husband, whose name I don't know. But I enjoy it, and I'm proud to be friends with a homosexual who is the greatest bossa nova maestro this country has ever produced.